This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
What we're going to do is basically Jeremy's going to present some things, and then what's going to happen is we will introduce who we are after that, because we come into the picture later in the process. So first, without further ado, Jeremy Deller, the artist of this project.
Thank you. Thanks. Hello. I don't know. I think we're going to share. Oh. Yeah? Can you hear me?
No.
How's that? Is that better? Great. Thank you very much for all those lovely introductions and everything. I'm going to do a very brief. I did this yesterday, so whoever was here who saw me speak yesterday, I apologize in advance, because I'm basically going to do a very similar introduction to what I've been up to the last 10, 15 years to put what this is in some sort of context, if that's possible. So I'm just going to show a few images. It won't take long, I promise. Oh, there we go. Don't worry. Close your eyes. We've got the old stuff in, apparently.
God, that's the worst.
And what about my other stuff?
Oh, we got the wrong presentation, I've just been told. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself and things that I've done without showing you any images. So just imagine, have some pictures in your head. I started, my education comes in from a different area than most people who make art, in the sense that I studied art history. I studied 17th century painting, sculpture, and architecture, mainly Italian and Spanish. So I was looking at really counter-reformation, high Catholic art for some years. And it was actually a very interesting period in art history, in that because it was the counter-reformation, it was a moment when the Catholic Church was actually fighting back and trying to win back an audience, really, that in kind of basic terms, it was trying to win back the faithful. And it did this in a variety of means, one of which was engagement of an audience and making the audience feel that they're actually part of a religious scene. It's actually all based on the teachings of St. Ignatius Loyola, but I won't go into detail. But anyway, that idea of engagement and of involvement is something that really has been part of my work from the word go, really. So after the university, I didn't work for some years, and then I gradually fell into being an artist just because I was unemployable, really, as an art historian, and and it was enjoyable, and I was quite good at doing certain things. And I suppose that a major moment really came in 97 when I was working with a brass band, and I'd asked a brass band to play late 80s dance music, acid house dance music. And I made a phone call to the top brass band in the UK. And these are very traditional outfits. You know, these are kind of 30 guys who play these instruments. They're amateur musicians, but they're incredibly skilled musicians. And I made this phone call, and I was dreading it. I was so nervous. And I asked the band manager, would your band like to play this music? And I described it in a certain way. And he said, yes, we'll give it a go, and we'll see how it goes. And that was a moment of revelation for me, because it freed me up from being an artist that had to make things. And I could be an artist that actually did things and made things happen, really, and worked with people rather than worked in a studio environment. Not that I'd really done that before, anyway. And that's where I found I had a strength, in the sense that I quite enjoyed making, you know, working with people and collaborating. So from then on, most of the projects and most of the things I'm happy with, to be honest, are things like that, on that level. So in 2001, I worked with Art Angel, which in a way is a very similar organization to Creative Time, on a project in which I reenacted a battle from the miners' strike in the UK, which is a very famous, notorious conflict in Britain. It was a civil war in all but name, but also this battle was a decisive moment for the government when they beat the miners in a very public sense, but also as a very brutal fight. And so I went back to the original site, and with around about 1,000 people, we reenacted this battle for the general public, mainly people that lived nearby. And the people that did the reenactment were former miners, about 200 former miners, some of their family, their children, and people who are battle reenactors, so people who every weekend will dress up in the UK as Roman centurions or Napoleonic guardsmen, or indeed American Civil War reenactors. It's the second biggest reenactment society in the UK is the American Civil War Society. So and the first biggest reenactment society is the English Civil War Society. So obviously civil wars have a great pull for people in terms of reenactment. And so we were, in effect, reenacting something from another civil war within the UK, a cultural civil war. Okay, invite people to come round and stand. What's that word?
Over here.
Oh, to the right.
If you guys can't, there's room over here, actually.
And there's a few seats at the front. So anyway, so that was a major moment, and that was a moment as an artist where it became clear that you could really do virtually anything you wanted to if you work with the right people, which brings me on to this project, really. In some respects, this is the equivalent of what I did in 2001 in terms of its scope, its sense of unpredictability, because, you know, if you... With the Battle of Orgreave, we're basically reenacting a battle of 1,000 people. So you're reenacting a riot, and you had to choreograph it. But if one thing went wrong, it could be a horrendous disaster. And so, you know, we had horses, we had dogs, we had everything really. And there's a quote by Stalin, which is, well, if you knew, you know, as we know about Stalin, it's quite sinister. If you have a man, you have a problem. And so with with Orgreave, I had 1,000 problems effectively.
We think about that a lot in public art.
Yeah. At least with this project, I only have 5 other problems who are the people that are traveling with me. But in the sense of the unpredictable and really going into the unknown, this is a very similar kind of project, the mobile version especially. So maybe we should just have a few images of the project at the new museum, yeah. If we can work it out.
I got it. I'm not backwards. God, don't ever do that.
Okay, let's just start there. So very, very briefly, this project arose from, like most projects should do if you're making this kind of work, from a personal interest or obsession about something. And this obviously came out of what's been going on in Iraq for the last 6-7 years. So it's pretty straightforward in that respect. But again, I'm lucky I'm in the position as an artist where I can actually make something out of it and do something with it. So originally, a few years ago, I'd been approached to make a sculpture in the UK or suggest a sculpture for the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square, and it was going to be a car from Iraq, much like the one we have we're towing around the US. But I didn't win the commission, but I got quite far in the process, which was quite surprising, but still, which was good in a way that I didn't win it, because it meant I could do this. I couldn't do two at the same time, two similar projects at the same time. So at the new museum, we have basically a static version of what we're taking on the road. We had in the gallery this central area, which is really the most important part of the space, which was just a kind of a conversation area, if you can call it that. We try to make it as cozy as possible, considering the sort of cavernous room that we were in. And every day, different people came with different levels of expertise and different experiences with Iraq in terms of if they were former soldiers, asylum seekers, as we'd call them in the UK, academics, and so on. And we'll just sit and chat to the general public. And what encouraged me was that people got it quite quickly, the general public. The general public seemed to get it quicker than people that sometimes who work in museums or work for art organizations. Not Creative Time, obviously, but the general public have less fear than the arts world about this kind of work. They don't worry if it's an artwork or not. They just will get on with it and have an interesting conversation, which is something that I obviously like and try and make the most of. So we had a process where people would come in every day, we had a visitor's book, and people would just talk. We didn't document any of it because we felt that was wrong, and legally it was quite difficult to do that. So we just let these things happen in real time, and that was it. I hardly saw any of these conversations because I was in the UK for a lot of the time. In the room as well, there was the car. Sorry, going the wrong way. The car, which we'll talk about later. And also this work, which is actually a bona fide artwork in the sense that it's something that I'd made. I'd made it with regards to the UK, and then I made it with regards to the US. What you can't see there It's obviously a map of the U.S. on one wall, including Alaska and Hawaii, and a map of Iraq on the other wall. And all the place names have been transposed. So it's been switched over. So it's just basically an idea of twinning towns in Iraq and the U.S., and maybe that might happen one day, and maybe there'll be some sort of civic cultural discourse between the two nations. And the twinning in Europe came first started after the First World War between towns in the UK and France that had suffered in the war, in the Great War. And then after the Second World War, it happened between former enemy towns as well. So it's expanded out to include towns that had been heavily bombed in Britain and Germany. So it's in that tradition that I made that piece of work. So, but taking this on the road is a totally different thing in a way. I know it's part of the same work, but the unpredictability of it and randomness of it is what excites me. And especially when I tell people in the UK about it, you can tell that they're visibly excited by it, because I think everyone in the world, or in the West at least, can understand what a road trip is in America and what it means and the iconography and the romance of it effectively. And we're basically doing that, but we have this vehicle, this leisure family vehicle, a vehicle that you would associate with holidays, but we're towing this sort of nightmarish object behind us. But I think that's it for my intro. And I think what we're going to do is just have a little conversation between us all. And NATO's going to say a few words.
So just to start, I work with Creative Time, just for the record. That's a public arts organization in New York City. And we, for 33 years, we worked just in New York. And now we've begun to work across the United States. We did a project in New Orleans with Paul Chan called Waiting for Godot in New Orleans, which was a reproduction of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot in the Lower Ninth Ward. But it actually, in many ways, opened up a lot of doors for how the organization itself can work, I think, because successful projects breed possibilities in new ways. And so, A, we're able to work nationally, and B, I think the board and the organization are not afraid to take on complex political situations. Good! Because I like that. Who doesn't? Well, there are those. I live in a city of those people. What I think we should do, that's me. I'm NATO Thompson. I think before we start a conversation, though, it'd be good that you get a sense of who Esam and Harvey are. And I was thinking maybe you guys could just... okay, we'll start with Harvey, according to Esam. And you guys maybe just...
start last night.
Okay, I see. And maybe you guys can just introduce who you are in a kind of brief biographic kind of way.
My name is Jonathan Harvey. I generally go by Harvey. I grew up in Philadelphia. I spent 9 years in the Pennsylvania National Guard right on Drexel's campus.
Can you hear him?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I've got a mic. I'm now an Army reservist based in the D.C. area. I mean, I technically live in Anchorage, but my unit is in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I just got back from Iraq. I was there from January through November last year. That's how I got involved in this. They were looking for people with recent Iraq experience. I also have road trip experience, so it seemed like a perfect thing to do. I had to drive my happy ass from Philadelphia all the way up to Anchorage. I did that with my father, so, you know.
Harvey, can you say what you did over there, too?
Yes, I did. I was a psychological operations specialist. I was the NCOIC, which means the highest-ranking enlisted soldier in a detachment. We operated in northwest Baghdad, which was a very, very complex area. I mean, it's only one quarter of the city, but it's a very large city with a very large population, very mixed population as well. So, you know, we had some areas that were very calm. We had some areas that got pretty hot. But basically, what we worked on, what we specialized in, was communicating with the civilian population. The role of the PSYOP soldier is to be the voice of the U.S. Army communicating with your local population.
My name is Esam Pasha. I were a full-time artist in Baghdad until the invasion. After the invasion, I worked very early with the 101st Airborne for around a month, and after that started working for the National Guards that replaced them as a translator. And so I got to see the war since 1991 has developed, and the air raids until it break out with an invasion, and after that, what's happening with the soldiers at first, the expectations and the frustration, everything. After that, I, as an artist, I did the first post-war mural in one of the big walls where Saddam's portrait used to be, after getting permission from the government and commission from the government also, both governments, the Iraqi and the American. Other than that, I worked as a freelance journalist. I translated for the press. I worked in some private security companies as an operation officer. After that, in 2005, I worked with for the British Embassy in Baghdad for the senior chief of police, the English senior chief of police, that is. After that, it got so strange and it got so frustrating, so dangerous also. So I moved here to the States. I came for an exhibition here in Minnesota, just a visit visa, and they couldn't get me out. Stayed in Connecticut and tried to work on having Iraqis artwork coming to the States, and we successfully made a series of exhibitions in New York called the Iraqi Phoenix with Peter Falk and in the Pomegranate Gallery. So that's what I was working on. I have never passed my mind that in one day I'm going to be like one of the paintings as an exhibit item in the exhibition. Very happy to be, very happy to see and experience this type of art. And there's a lot to learn from Jeremy, not to mention from Harvey. NATO's,
NATO, do you mind if I say something about this photograph?
Yeah.
This never really struck me. I mean, I've seen this several times, and I really like this piece, but it never really struck me till now, you know, getting a good look at the photograph where you can see the United States and Iraq at the same time, because normally at the museum, you would look at one and then the other. But one of the things that I think is interesting about this is that you can see how close all of the city names are in Iraq, because everything is it's a much smaller country, everything is close together, whereas in the United States, the cities are all spread all over the place. You know, it doesn't look very crowded, you know, whereas the Iraq map looks very crowded with those city names. And I think that's sort of, you know, interesting, because so much of you know, the war is going on in Iraq, obviously. You know, there's a lot of impact in the States, but it's much more spread out, it's much more diffuse.
I never thought it in those terms. What should we do? Should we just?
I think we should play that video.
Okay.
And then we're gonna transition to like what's going on.
All right, you put the video on. Basically, we're keeping a kind of video diary every day, which is going online, and we're trying to find our feet of how do you document a day in 2 minutes. It's actually very difficult for us, certainly, to do that. It's especially the first few days. The first day we had in Washington. This is our third day.
Which one do you want to do first?
Let's do Washington. Just put it on pause for a sec. It rained the whole day, so it was really quite a grim day. But we had a very interesting conversation at the end of the day with an Iraqi activist who basically critiqued what we were doing. So we thought we should put it on just to... I hope it sounds okay.
Okay, let's play it.
Yeah. reason. You start to speak about the obvious thing. Why you have the blood test? Don't take the blood test! And then don't want it. To control the rat is to control the biggest reserve oil in the world. To control the rat is to control the most strategic place in the Middle East. To control the rat is to control an example of a population that's made of various shades of powers. One of them is the Kurdish issue, which Iran, Turkey, and Syria had a Kurdish issue. And Iraq is going to be the example because they're going to have to face this issue, and it's going to be a model for the rest of the countries around it to deal with this.
So that was, did everybody understand that? Well, basically what he said was, he said, when I talk to you, I put all my cards on the table. Very clear. What I don't understand is what's your position, right? And then Esam says basically, well, my position is you believe that the Iraq war is a very important thing, that we should have a position, but there's many problems with Iraq dating back to the Iran-Iraq war and then back to the Mongols invading Iraq. And then the activist guy counters and says basically, well, that's very nice, but it's like you go to New Orleans and there's bodies dead in the street and you want to talk about Cajun food. I mean, first deal with the bodies and then let's have a talk. That was his critique, and we found that deeply enjoyable. and it's also kind of clever. And Esam is ready with his retort. I can see it. He doesn't like that guy having the last word.
I absolutely enjoyed the conversation with that guy, and he's really, really nice. I mean, this man has walked after 40 minutes of talking to Harvey and me. He walked a happy man, and he was like, I understand, and I like what you're doing, and good luck with that. But it's nice to have...
And the reason that's important is, I mean, it was a fundamental critique of the concept of the show as a nonpartisan thing. He was basically saying that it was morally disingenuous, possibly even morally bankrupt, to have a presentation where we're talking about the war, but refusing to take a position.
Yeah, he practically asked us to take a stand and direct your audience because we are pro this. We told him it's not a demonstration. It's a kind of relating to people. And I told him also it's not only about the wars in Iraq. I told him there are a lot of things that I want to talk about Iraq and seize the opportunity to educate people about the history of Iraq and the culture of Iraq, which comes first. If you want to know about war in Iraq, you can see it with your own eyes on YouTube. You can see it on the press. You can go search and whatever. And I would talk also about the war in Iraq, but the thing is, taking a stand, it's you take a stand. I have a stand of my own, and I can defend this theory and as well as Harvey and everybody in this room in different occasion. In this occasion, we're just having an open discussion about that. That's my...
I think this is probably why I did the project, to be honest. It was because I felt that I'd been left out of a lot of conversations in the last 6 years, and the fact that I'd read enough books. I'd read every book I wanted to read. I'd seen the documentaries and watched the TV, listen to the radio, and in the UK, I have to say, the information was probably pretty good in that respect. But nothing will replace either going to that country and seeing it for yourself, or meeting someone who's lived there and has worked for the coalition forces and has witnessed and experienced things. So it's really a personal thing. Again, it's just to be in a position where you can sit down and talk to someone about what it was really like. And that's just the kind of, in a way, the kind of person I am. I'm kind of a nosy person. But but it was a sense of being able to do that, but then actually expand it and make it a public thing, not just a private thing, and give other people an opportunity to experience what I had in that respect. But I think we're going to show the second clip.
Yeah, because I think it's important to note that the project attracts a lot of different political opinions, and to hear them out loud in a public space is... Actually, for me, very rare to hear these stories. So in some ways, it's been very interesting. So we're just going to show some clips of some other stuff that we heard.
Explosive after it was exploded, and one survivor of the three
four guys that were working there. Apparently, that they have plastic explosives or something, and they have it stored with the gunpowder or whatever. They were trying to make some kind of IEDs or whatever. And the story, they were truthful about it. It's they couldn't find the flashlight, and the guy just wanted to find where is that a generator or whatever. So he lit the match.
Oh yeah.
And I mean the whole apartment was blown up, and the walls that remained is like painted with blood. And outside here, for one hand, the rock feet
on the even for the smaller stuff, you watch out for the guys with like, you know, three fingers missing from their hand.
That was
sick. Even I mean you mentioned the kid, so it was weird going to South City and these kids are 8-10 years old and you know, their bodies lying around.
Well, that is kind of weird. A kid came with that food in a plastic bag and he said, "Who should I give this to?" And I was like, "Just drop it."
Yeah, that was weird. Yeah. We would drive up one street and there'd be another platoon one block over, and we just hear the firefight just going crazy and explosions, gunfire, and then we get down the street a block over, and we'd be yelling for him to go get inside, but. Yeah, they wouldn't listen to us, and sometimes the parents would come out and bring them in.
And that's when the parents knew the firefighters was up.
Yeah. You see us coming, go inside.
You have this trauma in the context of you feel safe here. But back home, you still have the feelings, the smell of death around such scene. You have this feeling of there's a people dying, so. Just about a minute, I was talking to one of the American people here, and he just saying about how this car looks and how it's broken, but I said, what is that to this car? There are 35 people dying around this car.
Okay, so on that note, so I thought what we might do is... we're just going to reflect briefly on our day and then really just get some questions from you guys. I think it's really good to just get the conversation going really quick, but maybe what we could do is just get Isam and Harvey to just talk about briefly what conversations they had today, which was thanks to y'all that helped out. And thanks to Philadelphia. The site was incredible. It's a shame we didn't get the Ben Franklin lookalike to join us. Tried desperately. But maybe you could just talk about some conversations you guys had.
Well, the fellow up there was a combat engineer in Iraq. He and I overlapped for some of the periods that we were there. So what was really nice with talking with him was that there were some events. There was a two-month-long period that we called March Madness because it started in March when there was a huge uptick in violence. You know, he knew exactly what I was talking about. You know, he was part of the Battle of Sadr City, is what it was called in the U.S. press. I knew exactly what he was talking about. We, you know, we had a common vernacular. And we had a guy come today as well in Philadelphia who had been a scout in Bakuba in Iraq back in 2004. And the same sort of thing where he's starting to tell us, you know, some of the things that he saw and he experienced that these aren't necessarily things that a lot of veterans feel comfortable talking with just complete strangers about, but I'm a fellow veteran. You know, I've been there. I've seen some of the same things. You know, in the video clip, you know, we didn't poll people, you know, to verify this, but there's a strong suspicion in our group anyway that the young lady standing next to him had never heard these stories before. And a lot of that was based on her facial reactions to some of the things he was saying. But because I'm there, you know, someone who has shared his experiences and, you know, there's that level of trust, you know, we're both soldiers. You know, he feels like he can open up. And that's something that I experienced as well. The last day of the show in New York, my brother came down from Boston. And I've never really talked with my family about, you know, my experiences, anything like that. But he was sitting about where Isam is to me now, and people were asking me questions, and you know, I was answering and telling stories, and you know, my brother afterwards was like, wow, you know, I had no idea that, that things were like that. You know, and that's one of the things that I think that this is good for. You know, there's a lack of discourse. And what passes for discourse mostly comes mediated through news organizations where everything is sanitized for audiences.
It was really fun talking to this guy, Corey, his name was. And
speak up.
It was really very nice talking to him. I felt that he was very much mellow and he was very confident talking about that. His girlfriend, yeah, she was surprised a lot, and I'll bet he doesn't tell her most of that. But I mean, he was talking about the time that some sniper, for some reason, kept taking shots at him, and he
said, only shot at him, didn't shoot at anybody else in their platoon.
Kept trying to get him, shooting at him again and again, and he said we kept looking for him, but this guy was good at one thing, good at hiding himself, at least.
Talk about that moment.
Can I just ask Isam a question? How is it for you when you hear soldiers talking about your country like that? Do you find it tough?
Well, I remember the time that I was there talking to soldiers in my country, in the bases, and I felt very much like that, standing between this guy Corey and Harvey. And at that time, I did most of the listening, and I talked a little bit. But again, there are some places that I feel that when they talk, it touches me, and I have to respond to it. Like when he was talking about the sniper, and he was saying, so after that, a colonel kind of thought the sniper would be in that building or whatever, and they throw bombs and on three buildings, and after that, you haven't heard from the sniper. And I told him, so you throw bombs on buildings and killed for this sniper and killed others. And he said, well, it's self-defense. So I told him then, that means if I come to your house and start and shoot at you, and you shoot back at me, and then I kill you, I would say, I killed him in his own house for self-defense. And he said, yeah, as a matter of fact, voice, yeah. So I thought, did he hurt me or?
But do you find it quite difficult listening to some of that testimony by soldiers?
No, not really. No, I don't find it difficult to listen to these things, but I just, since the subject is very important and touching both sides, we all feel the tragedy of that. The soldiers in here and there, the families of the soldiers, Iraqis also here and there, feel the gravity of the matter and feel the irony that both of us has been put in that position. Right. And that bring a whole unpleasant situations. Luckily, Harvey and I, we've been to very few that ended up not so well. So, and again, there are some concepts that I find I need to stand opposite to them, and I need to interfere in that and say my own opinion instead of before I was planning to talk about facts in Iraq and whatever and avoid my personal opinion. But then I thought, well, when I have to do that, I'm just going to put it down on the table, as this guy was saying.
It's probably more macabre than grotesque. I mean, part of, you know, the experience of going to a place where not only participating, but even if you were just watching that sort of thing, let alone participating, you know, military humor towards that end tends to be very, very macabre, very dark. It's in a lot of ways a coping mechanism. It helps you process it, you know, by saying things that, you know, in such a flip manner. You know, it's a way of sort of distancing yourself from the real raw emotion of it, because you couldn't really cope if you were trying to process it in that way.
Do Iraqis have a similar black sense of humor when it comes to tragedy, not just with this war, but any situations?
Absolutely. Making jokes about tough and even sometimes vile situations, but making jokes about it to help understand it. A lot of jokes about in the time of Saddam killing a bunch of people, Saddam removing a village, that brought a lot of series of jokes that people laugh about just to try to break this darkness of this thing. However, in Iraq, the difference between the military people of Iraq, one of them is my father that fought in the Iraqi-Iran war for 8 years, we have a different attitude about the war. Like my father, he said, yes, I was in the artillery
and I must have killed hundreds of people with the shells I throw there. I'm not proud of it, but I had to do it because I'm a soldier.
It is what it is.
It is what it is, yeah. What triggers me about this guy, Corey, is the self-defense thing. Don't explain it. You're a soldier. You're put there. I was a soldier in the Iraqi army. Luckily, I didn't get into any combat or any conflict. But I wouldn't say self-defense. Like, I was put in Kurdistan, and I has planned in my mind if the Kurdish came upon me, I would not shoot at them because, first, they are Iraqis. Second, I'm Arabian in Kurdistan. So, and if I would have, that's what I thought I'm going to do. Luckily, I didn't test that. I wasn't put in the test. But if I was, God knows what would happen. Maybe I will shoot. But after that, I wouldn't say I did it for self-defense. That's the thing. That's just my side of the thing. That's what I...
In D.C., we had a woman that came up with a quilt of the bombing on Al-Mutanabi Street. She was clearly a very lefty, liberal woman. Very much felt like Berkeley, where I used to live. And she quilted, and she was very passionate about it. It was quilted for the children that were killed in the bombing, where this car being killed, and she was... Tears were welling up her eyes, and I looked at you, Isam, and you looked very unfazed. You just kind of looked at her.
In fact, he said one of the most probably insensitive things you could say at the time. Well, tragedies happen all over the place.
Well, the thing is, first, I didn't want to... it's somewhat... I don't know. I didn't feel like I wanted to tell her that there aren't any children in the book market. I mean, if she made a quilt about a hospital with children coming on dozens, that would be understandable. What the Mutanabi Street doesn't really have children. It's all books and big books, and so usually adults are there. Maybe I've seen children there a few times, but it's not about the children. That's one thing. The other thing is... I asked her, have you seen the Mutanabi Street or pictures of it or whatever? She said, no, where would I see it? And I thought, I probably told her, or I don't know, the internet, of course, filled with these pictures. So, and she was looking at me and the children, and she started crying. I don't know, I cannot do these romantic, I don't know. Come on, I mean, since 1980, I was 4 years old, and I started having this war and Iranian air raids and whatever, and ending up until I left the country. So my skin is so thick. So just to mention a little personal thing, that the other day my girlfriend was telling me on TV, she was watching about a documentary about this girl that got shot somewhere by her friend in an elementary school that stole the weapon from his uncle. And it was like, and he shot the girl, and kind of started to tear and cry and whatever. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry for that. And she was like, that's it? That's what you're going to say? I'm sorry for... I mean, show some compassion. You're a robot or something? I said, look, I've collected human parts with my hands, and I put people into a grave, and I went to the morgue and stayed there for too long, and I've seen children died of cholera or even flu.
And this is an interesting point, because he was a translator for the U.S. military. Tours in Iraq for the army are 12 to 15 months. The translators generally stay there, and they're inherited by the next unit. And so they're going through the same things over and over again.
Yeah. The other day was, who's the sergeant that was saying, we come and serve for a few months and leave, and the others come and leave, and those interpreters would have an accumulating experience working with the army, so they started to know the army measures and the army procedures even better than some sergeants in there. So
I think we're going to have some questions. Just to say that we have a day off tomorrow, but we're going to post some videos, and some of them a video. I think it's going to be jokes in Iraqi jokes in... And with translations. That's going to be like our day off thing. But anyway, if anyone has any questions, please just put your hand up.
And we're going to pass the mic around so everyone in the back here.
My question is for Jeremy. At the beginning of the Iraqi invasion, George W. Bush famously said, let's roll, and he envisioned this to be the credo of the invasion. And I couldn't help but thinking of that when I saw the map of your planned move around the United States, also seeing your Winnebago, and just thinking of the spirit of adventurism that was enlisted in order to get support for the war. And I just wanted to know if you had any thoughts about that.
It's not in a spirit of a warlike in adventurism, if that's what. It's a kind of different kind of journey, I'd like to think, if that's what you're thinking. If I'm riffing on it? Not really. I think it's just the reason we're doing it is that I liked making art outside galleries or museums. That's why I feel at ease. And also I like going outside of main sort of population centres, i.e. London for me, or here it'd be, you know, we start in New York, we end in LA, and it's just, I like to take this idea in this exhibition or this project to places where people aren't expecting to see it, rather than going to the new museum when you're paying and you're actually paying to see it. Here, the audience is entirely different, and that's what excites me about this project. I don't know if that's answering your question necessarily, but
yeah, I guess I'm wondering if the Winnebago has any, if it's part of your art project. For me, it was as important as.
I think for an American, it means more. We don't have these vehicles in the UK.
Just in terms of the phrase "let's roll," that's a popular phrase. It's part of, in particular, among tankers in the army. So it's a common part of military vernacular. It's also when Bush was using it was probably a play on that's supposedly the last words that were heard from the flight that crashed in Pennsylvania. That the civilians on the flight that had made contact on the phone with people that were planning on going and trying to take on the hijackers said, "Let's roll," and that was the last that anyone heard from the flight.
That's true. I remember that now. But I think, yeah. So it's definitely a kind of a trip into the unknown. And so, like I think I said it earlier, we have this sort of family vehicle where we're towing this thing behind it, and I think it's. The iconography of it speaks for itself in that respect.
A question. First of all, to the two gentlemen on the left, I have the utmost respect for you to have experienced what you experienced in Iraq and be able to talk about it in such a rational and humane way is, to me, extraordinary. And I have a question. When I look at the vehicle and the destruction of it, the first thing that comes to my mind is the dreadful, terrible sound that must have been made when that happened. So what does it sound like to hear something like that?
Explosion?
Explosion, I mean, that causes that level of horrible
destruction.
You
don't hear much past the actual explosion itself. I mean, it can be, the closer you are to an explosion, the more powerful it is. It's something that you will feel as well as hear, yeah, because of the sheer concussive force. I mean, ultimately, what caused that was the concussion of the explosion. You know, that's you know, highly pressurized air from the explosion just getting pushed out and crushing that car.
Once you said that, you brought to my mind that those voices again, it played in my mind, and right away I thought it must played in your mind too. And something you felt, as Harvey said, with your body, you feel your whole body become like an eardrum. And there is, surprisingly, I don't know if you hear it too, but before the explosion, there is a split of a second where you hear a little, not as loud voice, something like, something like that. I don't know if it makes sense or not, but before every explosion, you hear a little bit of a buzz for a split second. It doesn't start loud; it starts low.
And this was a massive, massive bomb that destroyed the market. It destroyed the whole street, not just that car. I mean, that car wasn't the vehicle with the bomb in.
And those explosions are very continuous in Baghdad. That as we speak now, we hear them far, kind of near, very near sometimes, which is kind of rarely, but usually here and there, left and right.
You start to try and guess, is that one really far away, or is it was it small but close by? And a lot of times, you know, the sound won't really help you with that because it could be either with based on the sound, but based on the feel. Did I feel any concussion from that? Did the earth move at all? Yeah. I mean, it's something that when you're there for a long time, explosions sort of blend. If you've ever lived near a subway, you know.
My father was a hunter.
Okay.
And he had a 12-gauge shotgun, and it was the worst sound in the world for me to hear it go off. Terrifying.
Okay, but if you've ever lived near the subway, you get to a point when you first move in that it might wake you up in the middle of the night. After you've been there 3 or 4 days, you don't even notice. Friends might come over and say, "Oh my God, how do you live with this?" But live with what? What are you talking? Oh, that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing. When your bass is getting rocketed pretty regularly, you just sort of let it sort of filter into the background and focus on what you're doing.
If you see on the news, I probably should download it from the YouTube, when some UN high personnel came to meet with the Iraqi prime minister somewhat recently in the last few months. And they were standing and they were talking or whatever, and there was a big explosion nearby that the flag behind them shook a little bit, and the Japanese guy just ducked him and his secretary, and the Iraqi guy, he didn't yep. blink. He was like looking at him and kind of
That's how you can tell when a soldier is different units have different rotation cycles in Iraq, and you can always tell the people who it's their first deployment and they just got there, because when you start taking incoming fire, they look around in a panic or maybe go to a bunker. But when you've been around there long enough, you realize it's the explosion that you don't hear that's going to kill you. So if you hear it, you don't really need to worry.
Thanks. I don't know if this is a question or a comment. It's going to start as a comment. Let's see if it turns into a question. I'm a little worried that I don't know how to correlate the aim that you articulated, which is to open a space for dialogue, to have a place that seems to be anchored by this corpse of the car, where you're not going to take a position and you're going to let positions emerge or at least put them in some relation to one another. I'm having trouble squaring that with the ostensible title, It Is What It Is, because that is a position. Or it articulates a position which naturalizes or says that the means by which we use to cope with this horror and its duration is to say over and over again, it is what it is. This is our life. This is the life that we are making for ourselves. And I'm worried that is doing tremendous violence again to just everyday life. Like to say to discursively to lay the it is what it is on top of this reality simply fixes it in place. And I think that's instantiated as well. I worry that it's instantiated as well by this husk of a car, which is now being treated as a monument or memorial, like some kind of permanent, it's like the permanence here which we shouldn't tolerate. And I think the medical student was at least able, like, try to revive or animate the ghosts that are continuing to die, at least for him when he saw it, looked at it. There were bodies there for him still.
I think.
I mean, my real question, if there's a question here, it's do you feel that you aren't taking a position? And because I am sitting and listening to you, I think you are, and it seems to be one that. It is what it is. That's a position, and I want to know if you would agree.
I get your point. Two things. One is, first of all, politics. I mean, this is the thing about art. Art's an annoying word generally, but there's many ways that politics are produced. Meaning in the world is a form of production, and politics aren't simply Iraq, and politics aren't simply statistics and news, right? Politics are also meaning being produced in space. And this project, in many ways, is approaching politics from the how as opposed to the what of meaning. How do we produce a space to produce meaning in the world, I guess is the question that this project poses, as opposed to the what meaning should we produce. although it's misleading to some degree because the content of what is so intense. It's the war. And that's important. And the reason I think it is what it is so critical, it comes from a phrase that soldiers use, and Harvey can talk about this and Esam quite eloquently, but it's a phrase that soldiers use to basically deal with a war that they didn't start and they didn't necessarily want to get into, but they're there. It's a coping mechanism. And I think it's provocation when it's on the side of a mobile home with the husk of a car on the back. And what I mean by the what? I mean the how. It's that when we don't take a position, we make a space where soldiers can actually talk in space, actually. And people get frustrated that we're not taking a position. And I even have radical leftist friends who constantly, and I myself, take positions constantly. But it's useful for me in this project to see how not stating a position produces a space where conversation happens much more provocatively and publicly. And I think it's something politics on an activist side could use a lot of, right? Because where do you see that? And maybe I could ask you guys too about how do you, because it is, this question haunts this project, but I think it's also an important lesson for us as a culture that makes meaning production money. It's money making and it's news making. You know, the how of what we produce is just as important as the what.
Well, the fact that the car, we're towing a car, we're going throughout the U.S., is in itself, I'd like to think, shows a position and shows my concern. If I didn't really care about it, I didn't have a strong opinion either way, then I wouldn't be doing it. It wouldn't be happening. So in that respect, I think it does show a position, but not in the simplistic or a simplistic anti-pro-war position. So it's a complicated situation out there, and so the work shouldn't be so straightforwardly pro or anti-war. I think that just shuts down any discussion, and that's, we're trying to encourage it, not scare people off.
Well, that's the best what I like. One of the best things I like about this exhibition is if you are going to say in forward that this is our aim, we are with the war or against the war, that's us, you're going to somewhat force your ideas in advance before talking to anything, about anything, I mean. And you're going to have half of the people that would have talked to you just disregard yours, because those half are going to be from the both sides. Those who disagree with you, half of them are going to say, I'm not going to waste my time with that or waste my breath. And those who agree with you, they're going to go like, why preaching to the choir? You know, they're like believing the same thing that I believe in, so I'm not going to talk to them. Taking a position, as I said earlier, that everybody has a position. One of them is Jeremy and Harvey and Neto and I. But the thing is, we're not going to put it forward. We're not going to say we are with this direction and we're going through and we're going to explain to you why once you talk to us. No, this is, makes it more freeway and more, so much more interesting, so we can talk with that. And as I said, it's appeared when I talk to some people, and I'm very grateful that NATO and Jeremy replied for this, because as a foreigner, I kind of didn't get much of the comment or the question that's been said earlier. So please, people, dim it down. I'm a foreigner.
can I just add, just slightly before I forget, the title, it is what it is. The car can be that. I mean, that in a sense here, it totally refers to the car. It is a car that was destroyed at this time, at this point in history. And there's no getting away from that. It's not presented as an artwork. Look how we present it. It's not presented as a thing of beauty. It pretty much speaks there. That title tells you what it is. And we have to. That's something that has to be dealt with. And I think it's better if it is seen than it's not seen, frankly.
And there's also somewhat of a logistical consideration, which may or may not have been on the forefront of their minds. But of the 35 experts in New York that were on hand for the installation in the museum, some of them were pro-war, some of them were anti-war. If the project itself had a position, then those that were of the opposite stripe would never have been considered, and it would have completely changed the nature of the conversation. It wouldn't have been an open forum. It would have been a very discursive forum. And one of the problems with, I mean, part of the problem with the current set of internet memes is that it becomes a discourse of me, where people in general tend to look up websites and do research that agrees with the positions they already have. People don't generally read good, rational, analytical blogs or websites or editorials of the positions with which they disagree. If they do read anything of the opposition, it's the most biased that they can, the easiest with which to disagree, you know, so that they can set up their own internal straw man argument to reaffirm the legitimacy of their previous held beliefs. I know for myself, for instance, if the project were pro-war or if the project were anti-war, I wouldn't have even applied. And the fact that they affirmed at every turn that the project was not taking a position was very important to me, because there's a lack of public discourse on the war. There's people who read their particular memes on their particular websites, and there are the people, the talking heads, who shout at each other from their different broadcast networks. But that's not the same as discourse. And that's one of the things that this is trying to set up. It's trying to open up that environment where people can talk about it. There was a nun who came today who was asking Isam all about what Iraqis are like. And when he was talking about how much they love to read, which was important because it was a book market that got blown up, you know, one of her comments was, wow, I like that they have this commitment to learning and education. I had no idea. Because that's not what we see on the internet. That's not what we see in the news.
It should be noted she was a nun that was for the war.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, she was a pro-Bush
okay.
nun.
I wasn't...
kind of like a groupie nun, but...
But, I mean, so logistically... Had the project taken a position, that would have necessarily ruled out a lot of the people who got taken on to be guest experts, whether because they would have been selecting against some of them or whether they would have self-selected against it.
And, you know, we made a flyer yesterday because we realized we weren't really marketing ourselves properly, if that's the right word. And everyone, apart from one person, accepted the flyer that we've been giving out, which I think is... I've been quite encouraged by it in that respect, because obviously people are open in that to talk or to take the flyer, because they identify as not being either way a pro or anti-war statement in that respect.
And in terms of the phrase, it is what it is, can I just one thing about this? That was something that I later found out. Jeremy had never heard that expression until the interview that I had on the phone with him. And I had a friend of mine who served in the war, same company I did, last night stopped by Philadelphia, and she saw what was on the bus, and she said she had to laugh. And at the same time, she's a little mortified, because we say that so much, at least in our company, and it's among the people that I associate with in the military. It's such a common and trite expression of both resignation and acceptance and a willingness to accept the challenge. That, you know, like we said, we don't choose where we go. We don't choose, you know, what the country does. But the country does choose. And if the country's going to choose something, whether it's to go to war or whether not to go to war, then let's do it right. And that's really my position as a soldier and a lot of soldiers' positions. Let the politicians worry about whether we're going to go to war or not. If we are going to go to war, let's do it right.
Hi, I have a question for Jeremy, because you mentioned that the map first was shown in the UK,
yeah.
The UK map. And if I remember correctly, it was part of a show at the ICA.
Yeah.
And it was proposals for a monument to the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And a lot of the criticism that was directed towards that show was that how can we possibly make sense of history, that it's a history that is not complete and a conflict that is still happening. And it's unbelievable how many artists were keen to respond to that call for a proposal for a monument. And I'm wondering how much of your thinking about this current project, It Is What It Is, came out of that experience. And in the end, why did you choose this car to be the image of the violence in Iraq and not, for example, a military vehicle or something else that would symbolize that?
I think the whole point about that show was that it was a show that was too early, in a sense, and was trying to make sense of something that was ongoing. Especially when that show, when was it? Was it 2 years ago? Yeah. So I think that was the whole point of the show. In terms of the object, originally we were thinking about doing a mobile museum about the war, having maybe hundreds of items that we could have, but for a variety of reasons we couldn't get that. We do have some other items, so it's not just the car, but the car is, for a variety of reasons I wanted the car. Most of them, well, for a fact, it's civilian, because it's civilian deaths, and more civilians have died than anyone else in this. You know, it's like 100 to 1 or something ridiculous in terms of the civilian casualties. So that seemed to be more apt than having a military vehicle. Then if you have a military vehicle, you make it more like a traditional war museum, which we have in Britain. We have a very good war museum. And in a sense, this is something that could be in a war museum, a destroyed car. About 21st century war. This is more suitable for a war museum than a tank, almost. So it's something from maybe a future museum might have this in 20 years' time. That might be an object in a museum. But until then, it should be seen in different contexts, maybe. It should be taken around. And the idea should be floated that it could be in a museum. I don't know if that's really answering your question or not, but that's why I chose the car. And also the car became a symbol in the media, in the UK and in the US, but not in other countries, of a dead body. It became the equivalent of a dead body. You can't show a burnt body, but you can show a burnt car. So it really became equivalent of a body.
Lonnie is reminding us of the Air Force woman in Washington, D.C. There was a woman driving by in an Air Force uniform who was calling out of her car window, I believe, and asked if that was a car that a U.S. bomb had blown up, because she needed to know if she should be mad at us. You know, so something like that would also change the context of how this might be received in the United States.
But obviously, indirectly, it's a result of the invasion, but not a direct result in terms of, it's not an American bomb that destroyed that, and it's not an American vehicle, but it's implicated.
Yeah, but my question was also, I was trying to get you to talk a little bit about the possibility of having a monument at all to the conflict, or to commemorate the conflict in any...
Well, there will be a monument. That will happen, won't it? There's a monument for every campaign. The Gulf War monuments, there's one in Britain. So it will happen. What form it will take is another matter at the moment. Who knows? There's very rarely monuments to civilian deaths, and that might be something that could be considered. But at the moment, I have no idea what's planned. But I'm sure when the campaign is over and the dead are tallied up, the American dead are tallied up, there'll be some sort of monument in Washington, I imagine.
This is definitely not a question.
Good.
It's just a little bit of narration in relation to your narration, which is to say that I went to the opening at the new museum. It was very hard to see the project at the opening. I didn't get back while it was happening at the new museum. This experience of it today, this afternoon, is radically different. And as I sit here talking in relation to some things people have said, I have to admit, like, there's a certain amount of discomfort at this idea of not staking a position at not. And it's a discomfort that in a way comes from a couple things that maybe I just wanted to put out for you all as you go, because it also seems like one of the things I really appreciate about what you're doing is that you are four or five or six people who are living in a collective space together over a period of time with really different investments in the project, which is really brave of all of you. And there's something I keep thinking about in relation to Like a couple of things that I feel like are swirling around in my head. One is like truth and reconciliation commissions, you know, where the idea of speaking experience is a form of healing. One of the things that I think is uncomfortable that maybe people have already pointed out is that we are still in the midst of this conflict. And so the idea of healing from it, we're not exactly given healing, and yet the form of the project on the road seems to be one of teaching people. There's a bit of teaching, and yet you all don't, what was interesting today is you all don't come to people, you let people come to you. Which means that people's curiosities or their questions or their urgencies or their traumas or their needs.
More
or their
than we meet them halfway.
Yeah.
We were in the museum, they came to us, now we are coming to their towns and whatever. All they have to do is just walk in the street and stop by us. So we meet them halfway at least.
Yeah.
And it varies by person. For instance, the soldier that I spoke about earlier who had served in Bakuba, I had gone into the RV to grab something to eat real quick, and NATO pointed, hey, that guy's been lingering a while. He looks like he could use someone to talk to. And I walked up and, you know, started speaking with him, and he almost immediately started opening up. And in terms of healing, I think that's an important point, because I got the sense from him that he might still be really haunted by some of the things that he was talking about, because he was there in 2004, when he heard where he was from, where he had served, he said, oh, that's a dangerous place. I mean, so, and he had served very early on at a time when it was very traumatic. One of the stories he told was of a Humvee that had overturned in a canal, and when they pulled out the canal, they could see the clawing marks at the windows because the people had all drowned inside. You know, and it really seemed like maybe he's been able to speak about this with other people, but he definitely seemed like he was haunted by some of these stories. And here was an environment where he could talk about it. And not only could he talk about it, but he was willing to do it on camera. And that's kind of a big deal.
And I think the idea of the conflict still being going on, when the war ends, it will still be going on in people's minds and heads and families. It doesn't really end, does it, when the Americans leave. It will still go on for generations. So.
Did you finish your thought?
I guess the other thing that was swirling around in my head a little bit was the Winter Soldier testimonies, which is something that happened in 72 with Vietnam vets who came back to the States and organized a series of testimonies where they gave testimony to atrocities that had happened that they were perpetrating. And the Iraq Veterans Against the War did the Winter Soldier testimonies again a year and a half ago, I think. And that there's something, I'm not sure that I can quite get there, but I guess I understand, in some ways I feel, just a reaction, I feel that there are a lot of, that in the field of different investments in what happens on the street, what happened this afternoon when I came, my own investment in what was happening. It's an intense space. And I guess maybe my counter to the celebration of there not being a position is to say, actually, there are a fuckload of positions happening on the street. There are thousands of positions happening on the street, and that you are occupying them, and that people who are coming to occupy them are occupying them, coming to you, and that those aren't, I think, something to fear, actually, that those are something that you're identifying are part of discourse and dialogue, and in that sense, I think it would be quite interesting to encounter the IVAW, the Iraq Veterans Against the War, to allow for the space of position, because I think you're right. To drag this car across the U.S., it's not without position. I mean,
it's
no
a provocation.
Way. Of course.
It's a massive provocation. And it's quite exhausting being on the streets, because you're approaching people, giving them the flyers, and you have no idea who these people are, whether they're in the armed services, if they've lost a loved one, if they have friends in Iraq, if they have Iraqi nationality or so on. You have no idea who they are. So you have to be quite careful. In a sense, not that you're in any danger, but you have to do it in a certain way. But you're just really just approaching the public. in the most simple level, really.
And I want to just say, too, it is a bit of an experiment, this whole thing, in so much as there's a lot of assumptions about what the United States is like and what the public thinks about the war or not. And something I've realized very quickly is, like, no matter where you are, there's actually more people touched by this war than I thought. That, in fact, the stories we hear by people that just walk up, I'm like, you know, there's this idea that America's just distant. They're not feeling it. They don't get it. And then you hear these stories by people that just pass by, and you're like, my God, there's way more people affected by this war than you would ever think walking down the street. And that's been very powerful to hear, these kind of moments. And it is very complicated. I mean, we had a woman yesterday at Richmond who was agreeing with everything these guys said, but ultimately was not hearing anything. I think she was... She's a performance artist that protested in front of the White House for the war. She did performance art for the war. Which, you gotta admit, she's kind of alone.
Well, her dad is in the war.
But she said her dad worked for the CIA. She supports her dad. She doesn't know what he does. Very complicated. But at the same time, when she left, we kind of had this feeling like, you know what? I think we might have further affirmed her feelings about her correctness of position. Like, I think, like, she left there thinking, this project is so great, they totally support what I'm doing. And I thought, God, you know, that's kind of a problem, but same I don't know how
but
to communicate
really,
with her.
It's not really, because the process is what's important.
Yeah. Yeah,
the result doesn't matter. Yes. I mean, and you're right. There are a million positions to take on the war, and this allows anyone to take any one of them. And that's why the project itself doesn't really take a position itself. It's almost a meta position that, come what may, you know, you can talk about it from whatever point of view you want or need.
Right. Except that the ways in which the news have been so managed for us means that we don't see this until you drag this thing through the streets. We have not been seeing the results of all this stuff. So there is an inherent positionality in saying we're going to make visible what our government has decided to make invisible. And decided to manage out of our, you know, consciousness. Most,
the government
mostly.
Doesn't decide what images get printed in the newspapers.
Well, but
that's the news media, which has an inherent obligation to its advertisers to sell audiences.
But also, I mean, there is a right-wing interpretation of that car, which I thought about a lot. I don't believe.
Oh,
me,
I'm
I,
sure there
I've,
is.
I've thought about all the problems of this. I know all the problems of this better than anyone in this room.
I'm not even presenting it as a problem.
But I'm not going to tell you them. But but I, you know, you could see that as a vindication of the war on terror, saying, well, that happens there, it doesn't happen here. You know, we could go into a lot of justifications for it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's what this young lady was thinking. Mm-hmm. But, sorry.
But I was just struck as I looked at it today by thinking, this is the thing that I, as an American, you know, absorber of the news that's pretty much managed, don't see much.
No, well, that's exactly why it's there for you.
And in return, we don't see much the people that we meet on the street, like, you know, those that have those strong opinions about some matters, those who are really knows about the war and what they are talking about. We don't see, I mean, a lot of people there that I met and talked to, I have no idea they do exist. I mean, a nun that supports Bush in the war, willing to hear about how Iraqis read books and buy books the most in the whole region. And you know, it's very rewarding to have people listening to you, and I'm talking about something that I lived with, and to them it's new thing to hear about. And I struck gold when the Iraqi guy came and he was like, rah, 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 and said.
It's funny, too, because most people want to know what your position is, badly. People get very angry, like, what is your position? But they don't come at you with what your position is.
They assume.
And soldiers don't really want to know a position at all. Like, they never ask.
They seem to just want that space to share.
Yeah.
But
left
media,
activists get very angry with Isam when he's like, they're like, no, what is your position? How can you be in Iraq and not have a position?
I put my cards on the table, you put yours too.
Finally, Isam will cave.
In terms of the media.
Yeah, but after that, I mean, what would I tell to this woman that don't want to hear anything, just crying and showing me her quilt and saying, think of the children. Actually, at that time,
I'm thinking of myself.
I was thinking of,
I used to go there.
Of Helen Lovejoy, you know, from The Simpsons, where everything happens, she just cries and think of the children.
I just wanted to say that I think that one of the really powerful things about this
project is that it helps to overcome alienation. Just the idea that we can actually have conversations with other people that we may have a different view from is incredibly powerful. I mean, and the other thing, as somebody that's been around the left quite a bit and in my life, something that the left seems to have forgotten in the U.S. Is that activism, that a huge part of activism is having conversations. That, you know, if we look at successful movements in the past, civil rights movement or whatever, it wasn't only about having demonstrations and stating our opinion. It was about going out and talking to people, going and knocking on people's doors and talking to people. And so, yeah,
it was teaching
diplomacy.
Not just
I think that we have a lot to learn from this.
Maybe on, I think we're going to, that was great. Thanks, Lucia. And thank you, everybody. And thank you, Aaron Levy, Slaw Foundation, and everyone that helped fund this and get this site worked out. Thanks so much.